number 24906, reel number 4.
Did you have any contact with Lord Mountbatten?
Yes, I did, yeah. I used to go down to the airport to pick up the sacks of Mal and his Mal. And I'd sometimes see him down there. And we also had the job of going through his personal mail, not opening it all, but if there was anything suspicious there, we'd pull it to one side and we'd open it. And a lot of it was actually hate mail that he used to get from people. And we used to censor this and put it into a special box, examine it, go through it. And then it would go to his ADC, ADCON, his second in command, his secretary. And he would then decide whether to show Lord Mountbatten this mail or not. But some of it was quite virulent, actually.
Was it on any particular subject?
Well, on anything. People, I mean, you know, they said that he was the saviour of India and the Far East, but, I mean, the Asians had very little time for him, actually, you know. And he upset a lot of people out there. They hated him. They were still sending him this hate mail.
So most of it came from the Far East?
Quite a lot of it did, yeah.
So that was 2.5 years in Malta?
Two and a half years in Malta, yes. And then came back. And then posted to HMS St Vincent. Back to the old boys' training establishment.
This would have been about 1956?
56 to 59. Then I had a small break. I went to Royal Arthur, which was a sort of a moral leadership course.
Tell me about your role at HMS St Vincent.
Yeah, I enjoyed that very much because having knowledge in hindsight of what with the problems of a boy going through training, you know. I think I was able to deal with the boys there in a completely separate way. I mean, to give you an example, boys were always running away there. And as the disciplinarian then, it was my job to... They normally ended up back with me and then they were charged and put before the captain one or the other. And somebody would ring up and say, well, we got one of your boys who ran away and he's somewhere or other in town. And I'd go down and pick him up and take him home to Molly and she'd give him a meal and keep him there for a couple of hours, have a chat with him to calm him down because he was absolutely terrified at the time. And we'd take him back to the St Vincent saying, well, you've got to face the music, son, you know. And so we go back, and I could see from all the years back and looking as I was then as a regulating body officer, the sort of some of these kids and the fear and the unhappiness and the homesickness and came home to me because I'd gone through all that lot myself, you know.
Ernie Smith, Reel 4. What other things did your duties involve during your time as a regulating officer at St Vincent's?
Well, it was involved with the discipline of the thing. That's also when I first started getting interested in the entertainment business because I was asked if I would put together one or two shows for the boys on board. And I wrote a pantomime. And then I put on one or two variety shows for them, concerts and one or the other, and got some acts together, different acts one or the other, and I was part of an act anyway. And we put on these shows, and the kids absolutely loved it, and that was my first taste of the entertainment business, and it grew from there. So got to know the kids on two levels, one on the official level of being a boy seaman and learning all the business of that, and also those kids that had talent who could either play a piano or play a guitar or a trumpet or whatever, you know, and brought out those talents in them as well. So it was a very interesting time for me there. Enjoyed it very much.
Was was it your duty to administer the punishments as
yes,
well?
Yes, although I would not administer the cane, as I told you before. Yeah. I mean, I'll give you a small example of the psychology of dealing with a boy seaman. And that is that if you saw a boy walking across the playground, and say it was a Sunday, and you knew that it's time that they should all be in church, and you're wondering why he's not at church, you would say to him, are you coming to church? Not are you going to church, by implication that you're also going, you know. So it was a very, very careful way that you dealt with boys, because they were very sensitive. However, you know, bullish or aggressive the kids are, there's also a sensitive side to them, and I think you have to treat that. You have to treat them with respect, and I think if you treat them with respect, they'll treat you with respect, you know.
What happened after you left St Vincent that time around?
Well, the master at arms at St Vincent was a guy called Ken Etheridge, and I'd served with him in Malta. And I'd served with him this time in St Vincent. And he said to me, I've got a draft to HMS Belfast, would you believe, going to the Far East. And he said, I'd like you to come. Would you come along? And I said, oh, I don't know. You know, I've been here 3 or 4 years. I really don't want to sort of go abroad for a couple of years without my wife and my boys growing up. He said, well, think about it. And we talked about it, and we decided that I'd like to go. So I said, all right then. So he rang the drafting master Lambs, who he knew, and got me the job as his first regular anybody officer on board. So my next commission was HMS Belfast in the Far East.
Can you tell me about how you arrived on the Belfast?
Well, that was interesting as well. We arrived about 3 or 4 days before the remainder of the ship's company. We were all flown out there. The old ship's company was going off the ship, and the new ship's company was coming on board. And we had the job of settling everybody in, giving everybody a mess deck, giving everybody a key to their locker, giving everybody a station card. And so there was two ship's companies milling around, one going and one coming. And there was coaches arriving, coaches leaving. And the only way we knew whether somebody was new ship's company or old ship's company was the colour of the skin. The white ones were the new ones, and the tan ones were the ones that were going home. Yeah.
So were both ship's companies on the Belfast?
Yes, just changing over, one for one. That was absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. It was a nightmare situation. Guy would come on board and say, I would say to him, you're in mess deck D, Seaman's mess deck, and your locker number is 21, but I haven't got your key yet because the guy's still in the locker. And he'd go down there waiting for the guy to clear his locker out so he can take his locker over and his key over. And it was just a madhouse for 3 days. And the captain Morgan Giles, said, I've had enough of this, let's get them all off and let's go to sea and shake down. Let's get out of this bedlam. And that's what we did, actually. We sailed and we got rid of all the old ship's company, and then we sailed, got to sea, and we started settling everybody in, you know, in all their mess decks. And, quite an interesting time.
When was that exactly?
It was in 1961.
What month? Do you remember?
February. February 1961.
This was the first time that you'd been to sea as a chief petty officer?
As a petty officer, regular petty officer.
Yeah. How did that experience compare with being an ordinary seaman on the Birmingham?
Completely different. I had all sorts of responsibilities on the Belfast, which of course I didn't have as a boy seaman. I was responsible for the discipline and the welfare of the ship's company under the auspices of the Master Mounts. We were very much respected on there. We got over the stage of being feared, because once they knew you, once you were part of a ship's company, they respected you for what your capabilities were, not for not for your rank, really. Once they knew that you were a fair man and that you knew what you were on about, I think they, you know, you gained their respect. And drunk or sober, you know, they gave you that respect.
Can you run through the types of duties that you had?
Okay. Well, on a normal day, I would be, say, go down to the office, and the office was split with there was a mail office, there was a regulating office, there was a discipline part of it, and then there was a leave office, and there was a welfare. And we each had a section to deal with. And at the time, I was dealing with the discipline of the ship. And I would be typing out the charges, preparing the charges, preparing the anything to do with court martials, working with the legal department on board, the captain secretary, who was the legal officer on board. And I find all that very, very interesting. And then on top of that, of course, then you did your duty RPO. And when you were duty, you did that once every four nights. You were responsible for bringing before the officer of the watch any men to be charged for whatever reason. You're responsible for going around the ship, going around the mess decks to see that due order was on board. You went round at 9 o'clock at night with the officer of the day, round the mess decks to do rounds. And your final job on board was at night time, was at 11 o'clock. You went to the wardroom and you closed the wardroom mess down the bar. Saw the senior officer present and say, permission to close the bar, sir. And he had to give you permission because that was your job, and the bar closed at 11 o'clock. Because we said, well, give it another 5 minutes, RPO. And I'd say, well, I'll tell the commander, sir, and I'm sure he'll say, no, it's all right. Yeah, we'll close it now. Yeah, so...
You talked about other sections of the regulating department, the mail, welfare, and so forth. Can you tell me a little bit about those and how they were organized?
Okay, there was either an RPO or a leading patrolman that dealt with each particular section. No, the mail office, self-explanatory, all the mail came on board. The mail RPO would go ashore as soon as we arrived at a port and pick up the mail, bring it on board, distribute it into all the mess decks, and then they would make a pipe on board. Mail is now ready for collection. Leading hands of messes report to the mail office, and then the leading hands would all go down to the mail office, pick up their messes mail and take it to the mess, and then they would distribute it to their own mess deck.
Were there any arrangements to deliver mail whilst you were at sea?
Yes. Sometimes we would have a helicopter. If we weren't too far out, a helicopter would drop mail on the deck. Or sometimes we would get an RAF Shackleton aircraft with a parachute and bags of mail in waterproof bags with floats on board. And then they would be dropped at sea, and then the sea boat would be lowered, and then they would row out to the mail, pick it up and bring it back on board.
What about outgoing mail?
Well, that would be collected. You had a post box outside our office, and all the mail went into that, and then that would be collected and bundled up and then taken ashore. At the next base, at the next port of call, and then distributed. And what would happen was that the mail would be the mail would go into a mail sack, and there would be a lead seal on the top of the sack, tied up with the lead seal. It would be impressed, and it was like a Her Majesty's seal with a label on it. Her Majesty's Service, British Fleet Mail Office Overseas, and it would actually be dropped ashore, and then that would be carried as part of, it would, say, go to the consulate, sorry. It would go to the consulate, and the consulate would get it into, down to the airport, and it would taken off to England, and then it wouldn't actually be open until it came back into this country.
What about the leave section of the regulating office?
Well, they would be responsible for if we were the normal watch and watch leave for if you went, say, into a port, into Singapore, that you'd be allowed, if you're duty watch, you remain on board. If you were off duty, you went to, you're allowed ashore. And the leave RPO would be on the gangway to make, you know, just to check the cards that people were permitted to go ashore. Or if people were going on a long leave, maybe a weekend or a week's leave somewhere, then they had the necessary, that they would do all the documentation, all the administration to allow them to go ashore.
Would there be somebody waiting for people to return from shore leave at the...
Yes, it would be. That would be either myself or one of the other RPOs. There was always somebody on the gangway there. And we had the quartermaster, the duty RPO, and we always had a Royal Marine on board, on duty as well. They would come up the gangway, we would look at them and we would assess them. They may well be drunk, but if they were what we call a polite drunk, then we allow them to go down to the mess deck and get their heads down. If they looked as though they could cause trouble, then we would take them to one side and talk to them and find out whether, and assess them, find out they were going to be. Because you see, there's always a danger of somebody coming on board drunk and being ill and drowning in his own vomit or something. So you had to be very careful that you just didn't allow itinerant drunks down on the mess deck. You need to, for their own safety really, you know, to make sure that they are fit to go down to the mess deck.
Would there be a list of people expected back, and you'd be able to tick off the ones that didn't come back with the last Liberty boat, for example?
When they went ashore, they had a card. It was either a green card or a red card, and that was port or starboard watch. When they went across a gangway, you took their card off and collected their card, and there was a box on the gangway. And each in that box was partitioned with all the messes on there. So you took the guy's card off, and maybe say in the stoker's mess, you'd put it in the box of the stoker. At the end of the evening, whatever cards were left, you knew were people who were still ashore. So you had to get very, very careful that somebody didn't come on board and you didn't say to him, oh, take your card from there, because he could take his chum's card as well, and that guy could still be ashore or deserting. But you made sure that you are the only one that ever went into that box, and you handed him personally his card.
When shore leave was permitted, were there regulating officers patrolling the town?
Sometimes. It depended on what the civil situation was, and depending on what part of the world you were. If you were in a naval liaison town, a garrison town, say for instance you went to San Diego, San Diego is very much a naval garrison town, then you would contact the local shore patrol and they would say, we'd like you to drop a shore patrol with us, and you would patrol with them. If you go to somewhere like Tokyo, for instance, there was obviously going to be a language problem there. And so the Tokyo police would say that they would want you to drop a shore patrol working closely with the local police. So sailors, when they've had a few drinks, get very anti, get very hostile to strangers. But they recognise their own as family. As much as I was a regulating petty officer on that ship, responsible for discipline, they would allow me to say things to them that they wouldn't allow anybody else to. And they would feel more comfortable in my care than say, a Japanese policeman's care. And so we were there really to look after them, to make sure they didn't get themselves into any serious trouble.
How often were sailors allowed shore leave?
Basically, if 24 hours on, 24 hours off. So if it happened, so it happened that when they arrived at a port, that they were off duty, and they could go ashore, no problem at all. And sometimes it was midnight if we were sailing early the next morning, or sometimes that they could stay ashore overnight and come back at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock the following morning.
And who decided that?
That was decided by the commander, with the master and arms. I mean, the master and arms and him would liaise very closely. And depending, of course, on what the problems were ashore, what part of the world you were. If there was American sailors ashore, one always had to be very circumspect. You wanted your Liberty men to come back by midnight. Because otherwise, if there was, you know, there was serious aggravation ashore, fights, it could happen when you've got disparate naval forces from different countries. I mean, for example, when we went to Tokyo, we gave everybody as they went across the gangway, and they gave us their card. We gave them a slip of paper. And on that slip of paper, there were some Japanese hieroglyphics. Now, we said to them, if you're coming back late at night, give this to the taxi driver. Now, they didn't know what the hell was on that bit of paper. What I actually said was, take me to Hamruni Pier, HMS Belfast. So that's all they needed to know. They didn't have to speak Japanese. And then, you know, they were incoherent because they were drunk out of their minds. So they showed them this bit of paper, and they come back to the ship, so it worked every time, you see.
What about your role, the regulating officer's role, concerning the welfare of the sailors?
Well, there wasn't a lot of welfare problems when we were overseas. There's more welfare problems when you were in this country, because when you're back in England, of course, you've got people going ashore and they have family problems and they have children falling ill. But when you're abroad, all these things are very much divorced from the sailor. And it's only when they get into some sort of serious problem, when one of their children falls seriously ill, or the wife is ill, or there is a family welfare problem where the wife has gone off with the milkman or something. And then we would step in and... we would arrange for a flight back to them, arrange for some leave, arrange for railway warrants, do all the things necessary to get them back to England, to deal with their welfare problem. And talking about welfare problems, actually, the greatest welfare relief we had on board was a very large board, which was called the Dear John Board. What it was is, when you've been away for 2 years, 2.5 years, a lot of relationships. Ended after being at sea for a couple of years. You know, wives broke up from their husbands, girlfriends broke up from their boyfriends. And saints have a peculiar way of dealing with this problem. Instead of getting all upset, as they obviously do get upset, and go into themselves, they actually get they eventually end up with a letter from someone saying, you know, dear Fred, sorry to tell you, but I've found somebody else, and I've got another relationship, and I can't wait for you to come back in 6 months' time, blah blah blah. And so this is what we call a Dear John letter. And what they used to do is they used to get these letters and they used to pin them on the board. And you'd go along there and there'd be 30 or 40 of them, and you'd read these letters, you know, and then you'd pass somebody's mess down and say, oh, sorry to hear about Mary leaving you, so that's all right. It was a peculiar therapeutic thing, but it actually worked. It was quite interesting. Everybody knew about it. Strange, isn't it?
Where was that?
It was in one of the passageways. It was marked Dear John. Dear John board. All these letters on there. Incredible, isn't it?
we've talked about the regulating officers, well, the regulating department's functions. Is there anything else that we haven't covered?
Yeah, one of the other things is I was then getting interested in, as I say, was the entertainment side of the business. And I was involved in putting a pantomime on board, which I played Widow Twanky, and did one or two other shows. And I also, we had a room on the ship called the SRE, the Sound Recording Equipment. It was set up like a radio station, small room. So if you go on the Belfast now, there is an effigy of a wax of a sailor in there with a record in his hand. Well, that is the SRE sound equipment room. And I started running a program from there once a week called Records from Home. It was almost like on a family favourites thing. And I'd ask members of the ship's company to contact their wives, parents, etc., and write to me. And providing we had a record, we had a limited number of records on board, that I would play their requests. Very quickly, this took off. I was getting something like 200 or 300 letters a week. It was quite amazing. And then the next thing is that we were getting letters from sailors on other ships, you know, because we were broadcasting to other ships as well. And loads and loads of records, and it was always the same old records I was playing, because we had a limited amount. And that program ran for about a year. And when we went to Australia, the Australian local television network, a program called It Could Be You, heard about this program thing that I was doing, and came on board, and they televised it, you know, and they made a recording of it. But that was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed doing that.
How often did that go out?
Once a week, yeah, once a week.
Could you tell me about the structure of the regulating department on board of the Belfast?
There was a master at arms. There was three regulating petty officers, and there were three leading regulators, leading patrolmen.
Who was above the master at
arms? Well, the commander. He reported directly to the commander, and we were isolated as a unit on board, separate from the other chiefs and petty officers.
Did you also have action stations?
We did, yes. And my action stations, again, was in a turret, but this time it was, I think, A turret or B turret. And again, I was doing very much the same job as I was doing when I was a boy sailor, lining up two pointers.
Did you ever find out why?
No, I didn't. But quite interesting, we had an exercise where they fired the guns broadside at sea. And it was the most incredible sound I've ever heard in my life. It was absolutely terrifying. And I often wondered what it must be like in a war situation, you know, when those guns were going for real.
Can you tell me about the different stages of readiness for action?
Well, it was very much more relaxed when I was on board, because we were in a peacetime situation. The Cold War was going on. There was always the worry of a nuclear threat, and one of the things that we did exercise quite a lot was that the ship was fitted with jets all the way around, and we were able to absolutely shower the ship with water, salt water. Completely cover it almost like a shower, and that was cleansing it in the event of a nuclear attack, and that was something that they exercised quite often. But apart from that, just the normal gunnery exercises and torpedo exercises, you know, and the smaller guns, the 4.5, they would we would exercise at sea. We would exercise with other navies, the Australians, the New Zealands, the Americans would go to sea and anti-submarine exercising, all that sort of thing. That's a constant thing.
As I understand, there are different stages of readiness. There's action stations, there is cruising stations, and there's one in the middle called... did you go through those?
we did. But,
did that apply to the...
excuse me. Yes, it did. It was almost like a red, amber, green situation, you know. It was...